It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at the effects of America's overconsumption of food and fossil fuels.
First, a federal appeals court issued a ruling today on the legality of the National Security Agency's collection of bulk telephone data. The court determined that the program exceeds the scope of what Congress has authorized, but it didn't rule on whether it was all constitutional.
This was the first appeals court to rule on the legality of the phone data program, which came to light in 2013 after leaks from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. The ruling comes as a fight in Congress is brewing over whether to end and replace the program or to extend it.
Joining us now with a closer look at the ruling is William McGovern. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, before we dig into the nuts and bolts, how significant was this? How big a deal is this ruling today?
Well, it's pretty major because it's the first time an appeals court has found that the program broke the law. And so that's a relatively dramatic development. On the other hand, Congress is, as you said in your intro, considering replacing or changing the program. So this might just be the kind of last rites of the program in its current form anyway.
Does this ruling, nudge Congress to change this thing more than maybe they would have otherwise?
It might. I mean, it's very specific. The court really laid out a lot of different problems with the language. But they made it so that Congress could fix it by doing some rewriting. On the other hand, today, five senators, including Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, and Marco Rubio, who is, of course, running for president, took to the Senate floor to say, we shouldn't make any changes. We should renew the program just as it is.
Now, this hinged on a part of the Patriot Act, Section 215. That's getting a lot of attention in this ruling and beyond. So what does that part of the Patriot Act authorize? How did it factor in here?
Yeah, so this was really the centerpiece of the opinion. The Patriot Act, which was, of course, passed right after the September 11th terrorist attacks, loosened up the standards for what kind of information the federal government could gather in foreign intelligence investigations or national security investigations. And they've fiddled with the language a few times, but the most important word there is relevant, that the government could get anything that was relevant to an investigation. And the argument was entirely about what counts as relevant. The government's point of view was, well, lots of things could be relevant. Everybody's telephone number and who they called could be relevant because we could have an investigation for national security and want to go into that data. But the court said, no, relevance is not as broad as that. If it were, it wouldn't really be a limitation at all.
Right. The court said, if I read that right, if we say that's relevant, everybody's phone data, then why isn't everybody's financial data or medical data relevant?
Exactly.
We are talking about an appeals court ruling today on the NSA phone data surveillance program authorized, maybe, maybe not, under the Patriot Act. Ruling came down today as Congress is looking at revising this law. So remind us, Bill, what exactly did this phone data program do? What was the NSA collecting here?
Yeah, so this is what's called a metadata program, and they collected not the contents of people's telephone conversations, but mostly the information you see on your itemized telephone bill, if you still get one of those at home. What numbers did you call, what times, for what duration, and often information about the location of those phones if they're cellular. Now, that's the program that we know the most about from the Snowden revelations. There are other bulk collection programs that the NSA has done in the past, some that it appears they may still be doing. And this ruling would apply to all of those because it's about what Section 215 means.
And they did have to get some, they being the NSA, had to get some authorization for one of these foreign intelligence surveillance courts, right? What did they have to do to convince them that they could do this?
That's right. So what's interesting, I mean, there's a lot of differences in the way that national security information is collected compared to regular old crime information. And one of them is under the Patriot Act and another law called FISA, the NSA or the Justice Department can just go to one of these special judges who's on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Those proceedings are secret, and it's just the government that appears, and the FISC, as people call it for its initials, has been issuing orders approving of these of this bulk collection. So it's not that they just went off completely lawlessly. They had an order from this court. But the ruling today says, no, that court was wrong. This was beyond what the law allows.
What's been the argument for the usefulness of this data? As I understand it, okay, we've got terrorism suspect A over here. They call terrorism suspect B. We want to track both of their records, who they called, who the people they called, and I think one step further than that. So what does the NSA say they're able to do with that information?
Well, so this has been very, very hotly contested. How much has this information actually helped in national security or counterterrorism investigations? And you frankly have had some shifting claims from the NSA about the degree to which it's helped. The president had a review commission that looked at all these programs after the Snowden revelations came out, and their report tended to indicate that while it's hypothetically possible that the program could be useful, it wasn't clear that it actually had been so far. But the NSA says, look, we're looking for a needle in a haystack, and what these programs do is give us all the information that is the haystack so that we can find that needle.
And the argument against that has been most of us are the haystack. We're not in contact with terrorism suspects. We don't even have 6 degrees of separation from them. So why are you collecting all of our data?
Absolutely. And you said most of us. I'd say if you're really collecting telephone records from almost every carrier, then it's all of us.
So what are the options now for Congress moving forward? As you mentioned earlier, they're looking at this part of the Patriot Act, deciding whether to change it, end it, renew it as is. What's the range of options there?
Well, that's the options, right? This provision has always had expiration dates on it, and Congress keeps renewing it, sometimes with small changes, sometimes renewing it in its present form. And the next of those sunset dates comes at the end of this month on June 1st. So they're really up against a wall. They have to do something, or the provision goes away. But they can't quite agree on what to do. The proposal that's out there most prominently would change it quite a lot and would effectively end this kind of bulk collection. It would have the phone companies gather the data and then have the NSA ask in individual cases for particular people's data. But there's plenty of people who think that doesn't go far enough and others who think it goes too far in the Congress.
Now, on the court side of things, this was an appeals court today. It wasn't the U.S. Supreme Court. Could this still go there? Would it be before Congress acts? Would it still be relevant if it's after Congress acts?
Those are great questions. So it can't go to the Supreme Court as fast as that, right, because Congress is pressed up to deal with it this summer. And one of the things that this appeals court decision did today was it sent the case back down below to the lower court. There are, though, other decisions percolating through the system. There's an appeal pending in a circuit court in the District of Columbia. There's one out on the West Coast. So most observers think one way or another this bulk collection issue will end up in front of the Supreme Court. But it might not be, you know, this year. It might take a longer time.
You know, is this something where if this is ruled, it was illegal today, if it's ever ruled unconstitutional, could we see a court case, a federal court case against a suspected terrorist where information is thrown out of a trial because of the way it was collected?
It's conceivable, but of course, remember, the almost all of the information that the NSA is collecting is not really for use in traditional criminal prosecutions. They're using it to investigate and track people. They're using it to prevent attacks. But yes, it's possible that data collected violating the Fourth Amendment could get excluded just the same way as happens against, you know, drug dealers and burglars sometimes.
Now, this isn't the only story out there when it comes to our data privacy and the government. Is there another case or two out there that's going to affect the way the government uses our data?
Oh, there's always a big list of cases. It keeps us busy. I mean, one of the things that a lot of people are watching is continued cases about cell phone tracking and the extent to which government agencies, either like the NSA or like the police, can track the location of your telephone. And that's another issue that a lot of people think is headed for the Supreme Court in the near future.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's law professor William McGovern of the University of Minnesota. He joined us to talk about a federal appeals court ruling against the NSA's phone data collection program.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear from a guest who makes the case that invasive species aren't as bad as we make them out to be. In some cases, we should be embracing them, not fighting them.
First, studies say the United States by far outstrips every other developed nation in the rate of its food and fuel consumption.
Obesity rates in the U.S. are twice that of Europe, so too the CO2 emission levels. Our next guest is trying to figure out what lies at the root of this tendency toward overconsumption and what does it mean for the country's future.
Robert Parlberg joins us now. He is professor of political science at Wellesley College and adjunct professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of the book, The United States of Excess, Gluttony and the Dark Side of American Exceptionalism. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Robert, this is one of the first studies to compare obesity and climate change side by side. What do you see as linking the two of those when you look at America's habits?
The most immediate link is that in each case, the United States places much lower tax rates on the consumption of food or fuel compared to Europe, for example. In the United States, tax rates on petroleum consumption are only 1/6 as high as they are in France, and our gasoline tax rates are only 1/8 as high as they are in Western Europe. So we consume much more fossil fuel. When it comes to food, grocery taxes are essentially zero in the United States, while in Europe, value-added taxes are imposed. In Germany, they tax food consumption at a 7% rate. In Sweden and Denmark, at a 25% rate. So the most immediate explanation is Americans don't like to tax the consumption of food and fuel, and other rich countries are willing to do that.
So I guess the question there is why? Why would, say, European nations be willing to have higher gas tax, higher taxes on foods, and America less willing?
Well, I trace the lower American taxes on fossil fuels to the existence in the United States of a very large fossil fuel industry. The United States has reserves of petroleum, natural gas, and coal that are two or three times as large as those in all of Europe. So we have a huge industry that's grown up around these resources, and that industry's wealthy enough and politically influential enough to demand a very low rate of taxation on the products that it sells. When it comes to food, it's a little bit different. The United States is reluctant to impose taxes on food consumption, in part because of a populist tradition that such taxes would be considered regressive on the middle class and the poor. It's interesting, when anyone suggests putting a tax on soda consumption in the United States or on junk food, objections come from liberal Democrats and Tea Party Republicans alike. It's considered the wrong thing to do at both ends of the political spectrum. In Europe, they don't have as much compunction about taxing consumption of food or of any other consumer good. If you look at where taxes come from, in the United States, only 8% of all of our tax revenues come from taxes on consumption. In Europe, it's 20% of tax revenues that are much larger overall.
So is this a simple case of cause and effect? There are lower taxes and therefore Americans use more fuel and eat more, or are there other key factors that are at play here?
Well, there are other key factors. The distinctiveness of America's political institutions also plays a role. In the United States, we have an 18th century constitution. It's a pre-industrial age constitution. It's sometimes described as the oldest living constitution in the world, but it's also the least copied. It's a constitution that gives those opposed to strong government action many more veto points, many more options for blocking public policy responses to things like the overconsumption of food and fuel. In the United States, we've tried repeatedly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with, well, in 1993, a BTU tax proposed by the Clinton administration. In 2009, a cap-and-trade proposal from the Obama administration. In each case, the House of Representatives passed those measures, but they were then in each case blocked in the Senate. The United States just gives too many veto points to groups that don't want to take strong action against either obesity or climate change.
We're talking right now with Robert Perlberg, professor of political science at Wellesley College, talking about what he calls the dark side of American exceptionalism, and that is gluttony, especially when it comes to food habits leading to obesity and also fossil fuel consumption. And one thing you point out is that you think that America has favored, is leaning toward a policy of adaptation rather than mitigation. In other words, we're not trying to fix these problems so much anymore as you see it. We're just trying to adapt to them. Where do you think that's leading us?
Well, I see trouble ahead. What I predict, I don't favor this, but I predict it, is increased efforts by the United States not to reduce our overconsumption of food and fuel, but instead to adapt to the adverse consequences. When it comes to climate change, we'll make large, expensive new investments in the resilience of our coastal infrastructure. For example, what we did after Superstorm Sandy in 2012, Congress immediately voted $50 billion to rebuild the coastal infrastructure in ways that would be less vulnerable to the next storm. And you don't prevent climate change, but you try to get ready for its adverse consequences. When it comes to obesity, instead of growing reliance on diet and exercise, I expect the United States will increasingly rely on medications to treat the illnesses linked to obesity, illnesses such as cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes. We will make surgical interventions more available through better insurance coverage for those surgeries. We'll emphasize physical accommodations for those who are heavy and better protection against workplace discrimination. Those are good things by themselves, but they're no substitute for a prevention strategy, a mitigation strategy.
What do you see as the ultimate cost, just to take the obesity issue right now?
Well, if we try to adapt to the fact that 34% of our population is clinically obese, with new medications and better surgical interventions, for example, that's going to work well enough for Americans who are well-educated, have high income, and are sophisticated about how to access medical treatments and services. Already we've reduced mortality rates from type 2 diabetes in the United States among obese patients by half. But this approach won't work well for the Americans who are actually most prone to obesity, which is low-income citizens, less well-educated citizens, racial and ethnic minorities. These groups in America have never had adequate access to medical treatment and services, and so they'll be left behind. So our attempt to adapt to obesity is only going to accentuate unequal medical outcomes in the United States.
Now, over the course of American history, one idea that has been persistent has been this notion of American exceptionalism, that somehow America is different, a leader set apart from others. How do you see that playing out in the cases you're making right now with fuel and obesity?
Well, I think the fuel and obesity crises demonstrate the United States is exceptional. It is exceptional. We have an obesity prevalence twice the European level and a CO2 emissions per capita level twice the European level. But it's the kind of exceptionalism we shouldn't be proud of. There are a lot of exceptional elements about America that we are deservedly proud of, but we do have to admit there's some other things that have to be considered part of the package, and food and fuel excess is part of that. I would add food and fuel excess to some other things, including the highest per capita incarceration rate in the industrial world and the lowest life expectancy at birth, the lowest voter participation rate, the highest rate of homelessness and child poverty. We have a number of things that we shouldn't be so proud of, and I'm adding food and fuel excess to that list.
Now, you look at fuel consumption as an indicator of commitment to combating climate change. What do you think will happen if the United States does not fully get on board with a policy of mitigation of climate change and moves instead toward adaptation?
Well, the end result is going to be more inequality. The United States will be tempted to pivot toward adaptation in the short run, because we're much less vulnerable to climate change than just about any other advanced industrial country. We have only half as many people living in low-elevation coastal zones as Europe, and our agricultural sector is a tiny part of our economy compared to tropical countries. If we pivot toward adaptation, that's going to undercut the commitment of other large emitters, including China, which is a bigger emitter than we are already. It's going to undercut their inclination to mitigate, and so the mitigation battle will be lost. That will accelerate the onset of climate change, and that's going to make for damaging consequences for poor tropical countries in particular, who can't afford to self-protect. They will, the poor tropical countries have 10 times as many people in low-elevation coastal zones as Europe, 20 times as many people as the United States. They won't be able to protect against sea level rise, and they won't be able to protect against the drying up of glacier-fed irrigation systems. So the United States, for quite some time, might be able to protect itself from accelerating climate change, but it will be leaving a large part of the Earth's population behind, confronting an accelerating threat.
And we leave it there, Rob. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Robert Perlberg, professor of political science at Wellesley College and adjunct professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The United States of Excess. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Here in the Midwest, a lot of people are fighting very hard against the spread of invasive species, from zebra mussels to the Asian carp to the emerald ash borer. Invasive species have become public enemy number one for many conservationists, and plenty of expensive proposals are on the table to try and stop their spread.
But our next guest argues that we're taking the wrong approach to some of these alien species, and maybe instead of fighting them, we should be embracing them. He says fears of invasive species disrupting ecosystems are often overblown, and in many cases, their introduction into a new system can have positive benefits and help nature in a way that so-called native species can't.
Joining us now is Fred Pierce. He's an author and environmental journalist. His new book is The New Wild: Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. Fred, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
Well, we've got, Fred, this idea in our brains, invasive species equal bad. We need to fight them. You're saying, hold on a minute, let's take another look at that. Why do we need to revisit this idea?
I think we've got invasive species out of all perspective. We demonize them. We look for all the bad things. It's a little about like the way that some people treat alien humans. You know, you get humans coming in from another country, and we kind of demonize them. We look out for everything bad that they might do, and we don't look to the good things that they do. And I think it's a bit similar with alien species. Most alien species don't survive. The ones that survive, most of them fit in and add to the biodiversity in our ecosystems. One or two go a little bit kind of haywire and they take over a bit, and maybe sometimes we have to take steps against them. But most of the time, they're good news for our ecosystems. After all, we're messing our ecosystems up an awful lot with pollution and chopping down forests and so on. And I think we need the go-getter species, you know, the kind of American-type species that can move into a new environment and kind of take over and make something of what they've got. I think we need those species if nature is going to revive in the 21st century. So, yes, they can occasionally create problems. Usually we get those problems all out of perspective, and we never look for the good things. And there are a lot of good things.
Well, and you say they get unfairly blamed sometimes. Often the damage we might point toward is being caused by the invasive species. You say, actually, no, the invasive species is maybe just the symptom of the damage we, the human species, have already done.
Yeah, that's right. If you go out in the far west, you look at people, a lot of people blame salt cedar, for instance, for drawing down water. Now, at one point, we used to plant salt cedar as a way of bringing desertified areas back from the brink and reviving them, finding vegetation that would grow in those areas. So we get very kind of confused about some of these species. Salt cedar are now actually really quite good news in parts of the American West. It's certainly good habitat for American for bird species, for instance. So we tend to miss those things.
Now, you point toward maybe a misconception of how nature and ecosystems work. We have this sort of static idea. There is an ecosystem. It grew up there over tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of years, pristine and unchanged until these alien species came in. You say no. Maybe the alien species are the norm of nature, not the exception.
Yeah, this is not just me talking. This is a lot of ecologists today say, when we investigate what look like natural, pristine ecosystems in the environment, we find that they're constantly changing. You measure the species there, and then you go back 20 years, and you get a whole different set of species occupying the environment, not a result of human change, but as a result of kind of natural dynamism. So I think what's emerging is that this idea of stable, unchanging ecosystems that are, if you like, have evolved over a long period of time is a very false picture of nature. Mostly what you find is a much more dynamic, changing ecosystem, which species come in, they move in, they go away, some get becomes kind of keystone species, and some partly disappear. And that's perfectly natural. That's normal. And ecosystems cope with that. And it shows the dynamism of ecosystems. So when alien species, maybe brought by humans, move in, they're not intrinsically bad. Some ecologists used to think that, well, anything that comes in from outside is bad because it's not native. It's not, hasn't evolved in that environment. But what we're now seeing is that that kind of force of change is constant. And I think that means we have to rethink what we think about alien species. They're not a kind of just an alien presence that can only do harm. They can reinvigorate ecosystems. They're good news. And especially with the damage that humans are doing to natural environments around the world, I think we need to look at the power of alien species, invasive species, whatever you want to call them, to revive damaged ecosystems. For instance, I looked at what happens in Puerto Rico, which is quite an interesting instance. Farmers, plantation farmers and others, destroyed most of the forests in Puerto Rico. And then, the landscape got so bad, they kind of, the farmers left and went and worked in the cities. Now, which species came back into that nearly destroyed environment? It wasn't the native species, mostly. It was foreign species that had been brought in and planted in people's gardens, backyards. Those proved to be the most effective colonists. So when, this is a classic example of how when nature has a chance to regrow, to recreate ecosystems, it's very often these go-getter species, these colonists, these generalists, perhaps, but these species that can survive in damaged environments, that can do the business. We need them. We need them badly.
That's environmental journalist Fred Pierce. We're talking about his new book, The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation. He's showing sympathy for what's often viewed as an enemy. Fred, a lot of times we think of an invasive species as something, humans took from one place to another, entered it into a new environment, a new ecosystem, goes nuts and starts driving other species out, crowding them maybe even into extinction. Is that the norm?
It's not the norm. It does happen. You can get species that really kind of go on a splurge because they find there's nothing eating them and they're eating lots of native species. Usually that doesn't last for very long. The local species adapt to the newcomer. The newcomer adapts to the local species. And after a while, you find they get along pretty well. So, people get very worried, for instance, about zebra mussels in the Great Lakes. Now, they've changed the ecosystems in the Great Lakes quite a lot. But you remember how Lake Erie used to be 50 years ago when it was a byword for a dead lake. And you know what? The zebra mussels were, because they filter feed, they were eating up all this gunk. They were much better at eating all the gunk than the native species. They've actually helped to clean out the lake. Quite a good example, therefore, of an alien species coming in and able to do something which the native species weren't able to do. That's why it prospered. We may think that the Asian carp, which I know is quite a big issue in your part of the world, maybe that has a similar role to play in future.
We think of ecosystems often as having this, well, the phrase delicate balance comes up a lot, where you introduce this outside element, it throws everything else out of whack. How does nature adjust to most invasive species?
Well, nature is never really in balance. Nature, as we were saying earlier, is constantly changing. So that's the norm in nature. Change is the norm. So, I mean, you know, it can get a bit, maybe a bumpy ride for a while. You get a new species coming in, which does particularly well. But species will adapt. We look at the cane toad in Australia, which is a famous example of a toad with a kind of poisonous gland on its back. Even crocodiles in Australia for a while were getting killed. They were getting poisoned whenever they ate these toads, which they quite like to do. And the toads had been brought in from South America to eat some beetles on sugarcane fields. They went wild for a bit, but the local species are getting used to the idea that you don't eat the cane toads because, you know, they'll kill you. Some of them have even evolved so that, for instance, snakes, their mouths are no longer big enough that they can even attempt to eat the cane toads. So nature does adapt in strange ways. Either animals learn or, you know, a bit of Darwinian evolution kicks in. So I don't think we have to think of alien species, even the ones that do a lot of short-term damage, as likely to do long-term damage. They do tend to fit in. The other thing to say is most of the time they don't cause extinctions. They may eat a few species and damage the kind of the balance that was there before, but they generally increase biodiversity. North America has much more biodiversity than it did before Europeans showed up and brought in their species, brought in Asian species, European species. There's much more diversity in North America now, and that's true also in the UK, where I am, where the arrival of new species has generally added to local biodiversity. And most ecologists would tell you that extra species, more biodiversity is a good thing. Well, if that's right, and I believe it probably is right, then again, alien species are part of the solution to the damage that we've caused to nature in the last couple of hundred years, rather than part of the problem. I think we should bring them on.
We're talking right now with Fred Pearce about invasive species. In his book, The New Wild, he makes the case that oftentimes our fears about invasive species are misguided. In many cases, these species can do a lot of new, interesting, and productive things for an ecosystem.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea? Are we wasting our time and resources trying to fight invasive species, or do you think they're a serious problem? And should we be trying to preserve nature as is in the face of the growing human population and climate change? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking with environmental journalist Fred Pearce, author of The New Wild. He's making the case that invasive species might not be as bad as we make them out to be. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Should we be trying to preserve nature, keep invasive species out as much as we can? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Fred, before we get to our callers, if these ideas about invasive species are right, how does this change the way we approach conservation?
I think it means we've got to be much more flexible. We've got to think about encouraging ecosystems that work. I mean, look at how we're thinking about climate change, for instance. Now, if climate change is anything like the climate scientists predict it's going to be, climate zones are going to be moving. Now, if you think about it, how are species going to deal with that? The only way they can deal with that is going to be moving with the climate zones. And if we are erecting barriers to them moving, if we're trying to stop them making those really natural journeys to keep up with changing climate, we're going to be damaging ecosystems. We're going to be damaging nature. We could do a great deal of damage we think we're protecting nature. I think we have to recognize that nature, especially in the 21st century, is going to be changing perhaps faster than it has done before. But this is part of nature's adaptation to the changes that we've been making to the planet. Now, sure, we should minimize those changes as much as we can, but a lot of this is coming down the track anyway. We've got to look at it. We got to think about helping nature to deal with the changes that are coming down the track, rather than trying to protect nature in some sort of historical mode that it really can't survive in anymore. So I think the danger is that conservation will can enfeeble nature, make nature less able to respond to the challenges that it faces. So it's a kind of mindset. It's the way we think about conservation. We can't have this idea of conservation as trying to preserve everything as it has been. We've got to see change as part of nature and part of how nature should be.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Joe on the line in Escanaba, Michigan. Joe, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a research biologist, and I've been studying changes on lakes, Lake Michigan, where I live. And I have an issue, big issue, the acceptance of invasive species as sort of a new normal. I think we should go down that road kicking and screaming. Zebra mussels are a great example. Your speaker brought up, but there's a downside to this that gets very little media attention. And the introduction of quagga mussels and zebra mussels, the descended mussels in the Great Lakes, along with round goby, had an interesting interaction with native algae and a native botulism bacterium. And the introduction of those mussels, even though they cleaned up the lake, they have taken all the nutrients to the benthic zone, and that has allowed botulism outbreaks on the Great Lakes to, over the last 10 years, kill well exceeding over 100,000 water birds during migration, including loons, long-tailed ducks, redneck grebes, horn grebes, killing them by the tens of thousands.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. So damage to other important species from this invasive, should we be so welcoming to them, Fred?
Well, I think it's a loss, I guess, if we're losing some birds, and I don't say that we should dismiss that. But look, change is constant in nature. Change constantly happens. We're always going to be, stuff is going to be coming, stuff is going to be going. There are some species, there's some sturgeon in the Great Lakes that have done really very well as a result of the changes that the zebra mussels have made. So I don't think, I mean, I understand what you're saying, Joe, but I don't think we should confuse change with stuff which is bad. It can be quite difficult to imagine that when we're losing some species or we're losing species, you know, huge numbers of birds, even if the species aren't disappearing altogether. It's quite hard to sort of take that without some resistance. But, you know, there is good stuff going on as well. And I think we have to think that, okay, we may not like it, but in the bigger picture of nature, nature is rolling. You know, nature is doing stuff. Nature is changing. Species are going. Species are coming. That's part of the dynamism of nature. And I think we have to, you know, accept quite a lot of that and kind of roll with it.
We're talking to Fred Pierce, author of The New Wild, about invasive species. Take another caller. We've got John on the line in Highland. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Thank you for having me on. Should I go ahead?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. The comment I have is your guest is correct that the environment is in constant change. But we have changed it, for instance, with agriculture in less than 200 years. And I'll give you an example. There are native forbs, those are flowers, that grew in the areas that we farm in. And those flowers support anywhere from 150 to 250 insects, which are food for other animals. Now you got garlic mustard, all right, which I'm actually, the reason I called is I was actually out pulling garlic mustard, and I have a crew coming in for my first spraying of garlic mustard in my forest this week. Garlic mustard is a very aggressive plant and has been one of those plants that has survived as an invasive. That plant, in 150 years of being here, only supports about 3 insects.
Gotcha, John. A little limited on time. Fred, your reaction?
Um, again, this is a story about change. Overall, as I say, biodiversity has been increased by bringing in invasive species. So, you know, garlic mustard may not be the greatest one for local insects. But look, the basic change happened here as a result of the farming system, and you can't really blame the alien species for that. If we change the environment, if we pollute the environment, if we damage the environment in different ways with farming systems and so on, some species are going to lose out, and some species are going to take advantage. And if you like, they're invasive species, and some native species suddenly become invasive in this environment, and some alien species that have come in from outside become invasive and take over. If we want to do, you know, if we want to prevent these things from happening, I guess we've got to do something. We've got to rein back on the farming systems or do something about the pollution. But at any rate, we have to accept that if we're changing environments in many ways, we're going to start getting different assemblies of species, and there's really nothing at all that we can do about that. And sometimes these are really good things. I took a look at the example of San Francisco Bay, for instance, which is the epitome of an invaded ecosystem. Ecologists say it's one of the most invaded bays in the world. And you might expect that would be a recipe for disaster. Species are coming from all over the world, a lot on ships, in ballast tanks. With people moving across the U.S. over the last 200 years. Loads and loads of new species moving into that bay. And yet, that bay has just been recommended by the U.S. government and accepted by international agencies as a wetland of international importance for its biodiversity. So even though it's a wetland in a bay in constant flux, new species coming in all the time, a constant change of variety, it is in rude health. It's in rude ecological health. So again, I said earlier, I think we can't, especially given the kind of things that humans are doing to the environment day in, day out, we can't think about change as being bad. We've got to see change, in my view, as part of how nature is responding to what we're doing to the environment. Now, I'm not...
Fred, we'll leave it there. Fred Pierce, thanks for joining us. That's Fred Pierce, author of The New Wild, Why Invasive Species Will Be Nature's Salvation.